We're going to call the meeting back to order. And the first item is 5, update on the State Water Resource Control Board. I'm sorry, I was reading the cannabis. We're not going there. The Marine Life Protection Act and Nexus with Water Quality Protection. And we'll call on Becky Oda from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife and Aaron Meyer from the Ocean Science Trust.
Thank you, Chairman Corbett and board members. Thank you very much for inviting Aaron and I. And I am Becky Oda. I am with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife Marine Region. And under my, I am the Habitat Conservation Program Manager. So under me are three projects: the Environmental Review and Water Quality Project, the Statewide MPA Management Project, and then we have a Outreach Coordination Project with an emphasis on MPAs. So today, I have to be smarter than the clicker, so hold on a second. There we go. So today, Aaron and I will be co-presenting. I'm going to start us out with an overview of the Marine Life Protection Act, the design and designation of the and the planning process for the marine protected areas, and then current management. How are we managing these marine protected areas, or MPAs? At that point, after the management discussion, I will pass the baton to Erin, and she will go over more of monitoring, and then also more on water quality and how that fits in.
And I have one question for housekeeping reasons. Are you going to wait till Paul completes his presentation or not?
Yes, we will not leave Paul alone.
And then don't leave after Paul's finished presenting.
We will.
For approximately 2 minutes.
We will not leave until you give us the high sign.
Okay.
All right. Okay. So, and I will try not to put everyone to sleep. Or add to the lunch kind of afternoon comatose state, but we will try to keep you engaged and excited. So first up is, what the heck is the Marine Life Protection Act? And the Marine Life Protection Act was signed into law in 1999, and it is applied to state waters from the high tide line out to 3 miles, and also includes our offshore islands here in the state of California. So in response to existing MPAs that did exist before 1999, that had been created and adopted throughout the state on a piecemeal basis without a cohesive plan or sound scientific guidelines. So the legislature decided that we need to change that up. Pursuant to the MLPA, all existing state marine protected areas were to be re-evaluated and potentially redesigned, and to the extent possible, and this is important, to function as a statewide network of MPAs. It identified specific goals to help improve the design and management of the new system, and identified marine reserves as the critical component of the MPA network, or the backbone of the network. The MLPA also mandated that the Department of Fish and Wildlife prepare and the Fish and Game Commission adopt a Marine Life Protection Act master plan as a guidance document to guide through the process. And there was a 2008 version of the master plan that was more of a guidance for the planning and the design and the designation process. And then recently, and I'll mention it again later, we have a final plan that the Fish and Game Commission just adopted in August that is more about guiding us forward in management of the MPAs. Then in the year 2000, the Marine Managed Areas Improvement Act was signed into law and established a simplified classification system for state managed areas, of which MPAs and ASBSs are a subset of those marine managed areas. It clarified the roles of the Department of Fish and Wildlife, the State Department, State Parks, and the State Water Board as the three primary managing agencies for the marine protected areas. And the Fish and Game Commission is having the authority to adopt and implement those MPAs. In addition to that, in 2013, the Ocean Protection Council, through separate legislation, was given direct policy over marine protected areas. So between the managing agencies and the Fish and Game Commission and the Ocean Protection Council, those are the main components of the management of these MPAs, and much more, as you will hear. It's important to point out, though, that the MLPA and the MMAIA did not usurp the authority of other permitting agencies and their jurisdiction. At all. However, overlapping authority and jurisdiction can bring up some challenges. And so all the more reason why coordinating and collaborating with those other state agencies and federal agencies that have overlapping jurisdiction is a real key component in the management as we go forward of these MPAs. Okay. Smarter than nothing. So the MLPA contains six goals. In summary, they include the protection of the biodiversity, habitats, and ecosystems of the marine region, of the marine environment and estuarine environment, improve recreational and educational opportunities, ensure the MPAs are managed as a network, and required monitoring and evaluation. And then some of the requirements are it had to be science-based process, it had to involve stakeholders and other interested parties, and then also adaptive management. And that is a real key component of the MLPA and MAIA and moving forward is that adaptive management. We don't know everything at the beginning. We're going to learn as we go. Even if we fail in what we do, we're going to learn from those failures. And that is actually in the definition of adaptive management in the legislation, which I happen to really be fond of. Okay. The next one. So it was recognized early on that there would need to be a multitude of designations to meet the goals of the Act, and that each designation was going to bring a different level of that protection that the law calls out. So in order to do that, it's really difficult to find a map with every single designation on it, but it's got most of them on there. And so there are state marine reserves, which are red, and they should be red on all the outreach materials that you see coming out on MPAs. Then the state marine park, they are in yellow, which are not on this map. And one note about state marine parks, and the reason there aren't too many on the map that's over here in the corner, is that it has to be the Fish and Game Commission cannot adopt state marine parks. The Parks Commission needs to do that. So there needs to be an agreement and a coordination between those two commissions to make that happen. One of the only ones we have so far with overlapping jurisdiction is Cambria, SMCA, State Marine Conservation Area, and Cambria State Park. So that's why you don't see the yellow on there. And then State Marine Recreational Management Area, or what we like to call a SMRMA, and those are found in green, and those are the state recreational management areas and set up really to allow for waterfowl hunting in specific areas. And then in addition to that, special closures. While special closures are not really truly a marine protected area, or it's sort of a managed area, it's not under the MLPA, but throughout the process, out of interest from stakeholders, scientists, state employees, and many others, they are there to protect haul-out areas for marine mammals or nesting birds in a lot of the offshore rocks. There are a number of special closures up and down the state, and they are found in pink. Because of the sheer scope of this endeavor that the legislature had the state do, the state was divided up actually into five regions: the North Coast, the North Central Coast, the Central Coast region, and the South Coast, and then San Francisco Bay. San Francisco Bay has not been addressed yet. It was something that the Resources Secretary and the Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife decided that until the water issues are a little more concrete and in place and solved, because as we are going to be talking about today, water is a critical component for these MPAs, and with San Francisco Bay being our largest estuary in the state, it kind of makes sense to wait. So that particular region is not a part of the network that we're talking about today, and at some point in time will be added. When that's decided, I'm not quite sure. So stay tuned on that one for sure. Then moving on, so how did we do this? This is a slide that tries to help simplify what the process was like. It was one of the largest stakeholder driven processes that that I know of, for sure, for the department and maybe even the state, that was held. And to help the state implement that, there was an MLPA initiative, which was a public-private partnership, that was established and formalized through a memorandum of understanding between the Department of Fish and Wildlife, the Resources Agency, and then the Resources Legacy Fund, to help pull this together and help guide and provide support and assistance in getting this process done. Guidance for the process was provided by that 2008 master plan and by several groups in each region. Each region had a regional stakeholder group, a science advisory team, and the Blue Ribbon Task Force. And then there were special interest groups that also helped to advise. The department was involved in the whole process. We provided guidance on the feasibility of enforcement and feasibility of management of the MPAs, along with our expertise on the knowledge of the various species and habitats and resources. And what would happen is that the Blue Ribbon Task Force that was appointed by the Resources Secretary, the Science Advisory Team by the Department of Fish and Wildlife Director, the Blue Ribbon Task Force provided policy oversight for the overall group. The regional stakeholder group is really where the meat was for the designation and the proposals for the MPAs. The MPA proposals were driven by the regional stakeholder group. They were the ones with advice from the science advisory team, from oversight and guidance from the Blue Ribbon Task Force, from the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and from the initiative staff, giving them guidance on their various expertise of where they might consider it based on science guidelines that the science advisory team set up. Through all of those guidance bodies, the regional stakeholder groups then outline various different proposals for where to place these various MPAs and the types of MPAs that should go in the different regions. Once that was done, the Blue Ribbon Task Force would then provide the proposals. They would make some determinations on their own, help make a final decisions on what proposals would go forward to the Fish and Game Commission for consideration and adoption down the road. And then they then pass the baton over to the Fish and Game Commission. At that point, the planning and designation process was done, but more work was to be done to actually get them adopted and regulations put in place. And the department was still involved in that, as well as regional stakeholder group members as they came and went to the commission and provided feedback on what they did and why. So given all of that, how did we do? Not too bad. What we ended up with is California being home to the largest scientifically designed stakeholder-driven network of marine protected areas in the nation. We are recognized here in California worldwide on the process, the MPAs that we have in place, how we got them there, and have been a model for many other places, including areas in the country that already have MPAs and are looking to augment those. And so we ended up with 124 MPAs and 15 special closures. that encompass approximately 16% of California's jurisdictional waters, including waters around the offshore islands. And over 9% of California's waters are in no-take MPAs. Prior to the redesigning of the Marine Protected Areas, or MPAs, only 2.7% of state waters had marine protected areas in them, with 0.2% being in marine reserves. So a considerable increase in the number of marine protected areas we have in the state, and a variety of the types of marine protected areas we have in the state. The North and South Coast areas and regions were adopted, just as a point of interest and kind of a cornerstone, were adopted in 2012. The North Central Coast was adopted in 2013. I have 2019, which is absolutely not true. It was 2009. And then maybe there's going to be a change in 20. Then the Central Coast was adopted in 2007. So where does science come in? And I mentioned that several times that the legislature had mandated that this be a science-driven process and decision-making process about where these MPAs were going to be. And the integration of science into California's MPA was backed up by a strong legal mandate for that science and design, the development of a science advisory team, or the SAT, made up of diverse experts, a planning process structured to integrate science into design and decision-making process, and simple science-based MPA design guidelines, linked MPAs, goals, and then stakeholder design MPAs with guidance from the science advisory team. And what about water quality? So the Marine Life Protection Act and the Marine Managed Areas Improvement Act was not a water quality-based piece of legislation. It was not called out specifically in the legislation. However, it was recognized by the state, by the regional stakeholders, by the scientists, by just about everybody, that water quality was really important to the success of the MPAs for a lot of different reasons. In order to be able to assess the success of the MPAs and how they're functioning, water quality was going to be a key component to that success. So as a result, the kind of the history of how water quality was incorporated or not into the MLPA planning and designation process for the Central Coast, again, which was adopted back in 2007, water quality was not really considered at all. They didn't really talk about it. Part of that, I think, was likely because it wasn't mandated by the legislation to do that, and it was the first one to be designated, and everybody was still learning. And remember that adaptive management piece? We really, truly did learn as we went into each region how to change things with still meeting the guidelines and following the guidelines of the master plan. Then in the North Central Coast, there was an overview by the science advisory team of the water quality concerns and protections, but no real formal recommendations. And essentially, it was done towards the end of the planning process. And they looked at issues and talked about issues within the region, such as how water quality is managed by the water board and by the regional boards, and where the areas of special biological, significant biological areas are. And on this map over here, you have to really get up really close, but the ASBSs are on this map, this large map over here that's showing all of the MPAs. And over on the right of that, it's the allowed uses in those MPAs. And when this map is being refined and corrected because it's a little out of date, and when that's done, I will be sending to your offices multiple copies of this poster for you guys. So in the South Coast, there was a more formal work group out of the science advisory team to develop criteria and subsequent evaluations on those MPA proposals. So we're starting to increase that awareness and that discussion about water quality into the MPA planning. on the North Coast followed the same as the South Coast did and continued the water quality evaluations as they moved into those proposal discussions. What the Science Advisory Team recommended was co-location where possible with ASBSs and or just, you know, overall the state water quality protection areas like ASBSs. And what they did is that they divided what the regional stakeholder group proposals were shaping up to be like and said, okay, if you put an MPA, you know, over an ASBS or close to an ASBS, your evaluation got pretty good points. It got a good score. If you were wanting to put in an MPA or did put an MPA near stormwater runoff or other non-point source pollution or, you know, any number of those things, it got more of a negative score. So that's how the water quality work group scored those proposals in terms of water quality. In addition to this, the SAP provided some guidance on specific water quality areas to avoid, such as the Samoa pulp mill outfall up on the North Coast. The water quality guidance was designed to be used secondarily to the primary evaluations in the planning process since it didn't mandate. But they did start looking at those more in the South Coast and in the North Coast. It, again, was recognized as really critical for the major success of the MPAs. And this is just to show you a map of some of the North Coast marine protected areas overlaying the ASBSs on the North Coast, with the red, again, being state marine reserves, and the blue meaning state marine conservation areas. And to back up just a little bit, a state marine reserve means there is no activity, no action, no extraction allowed in those reserves. The state conservation area allows a certain amount, both recreational and commercial. State marine parks don't allow any commercial. SMRMA, again, was for wildlife hunting. And then the special closures I mentioned, what they were for. Okay, so another connection was that in 2012, the State Water Quality Control Board passed a resolution that directed the state board staff to work with the regional boards to implement a lot of things that were in that resolution. And it basically called for looking into developing more of those state water quality protection areas and what that might look like. And then again, it would be done at the regional board level. There were other issues that were identified in the resolution as well. And subsequently, the ocean plan was amended also in 2012 to reflect the contents of the resolution for water quality and the connection to marine protected areas. So given all that, that's the nexus a little bit, starting to tease you a little bit, on the nexus of water quality and MPAs. We got better as we went along, and we're continuing to do more, as you'll hear more from Aaron in just a few minutes. So what are we doing now on the management of the MPAs? They're all in place. They're designed. They're adopted. By 2012, all four coastal regions of MPAs were adopted, and the coastal network was complete. While management was ongoing as regions were completed, a more comprehensive approach to management was developed and outlined in the final master plan that I mentioned already for the marine protected areas adopted by the commission in August. And see, I didn't mean to put you to sleep. The state is moving from a regional approach to a statewide approach for management while incorporating regional considerations. Initially, there was baseline monitoring for each region to get a snapshot of what was going on, and a report out every 5 years is what the original master plan called for, to give an assessment and an update and a management update to the Fish and Game Commission. That's just not sustainable. Biologically, it's not, doesn't make sense. Cost effective, it doesn't make sense. So in this new master plan, we are moving to a statewide approach to management, and I'll get into that in a second, plus a 10-year formal review with the Fish and Game Commission. Doesn't mean regional work won't continue, like monitoring and outreach and so on and so forth. But the MPA management plan, or excuse me, program is composed of these four core components. There's outreach and education, research and monitoring, which is where the monitoring comes in, obviously, enforcement and compliance, and policy and permitting. And this poster and other posters that I'll also send you, because I forgot them in the car because it was dark and I was tired, we are doing a lot of outreach, not just the department, but you'll hear from Paul with the collaborative network. We have lots of partners, and I'll talk about them in a second, that are doing great outreach materials for MPAs. There's still more to be done. There are blogs out there that the department has done, these kinds of maps. These are guidebooks, which are given to the public. I don't have a lot of them now because we're in transition. We've got to get more printed. But they're guidebooks for every region that gives a map and also what the regulations are. There are brochures that also do the same thing for all regions and giving more information. In addition to that, on our website, which you'll see at the end, there are some things like these overview sheets, which are a snapshot of each MPA, and again, what the regulations are, why it was formed, and so on and so forth. So lots of outreach and education, not only for just educating the public that they're there, but enforcement and enforcement critically needs good outreach and accurate messaging and accurate information going out on the MPAs to be able to make their enforcement cases. So it's really important. And then policy and permitting. And research and monitoring is a critical component. It was called out in the plan. It's called out in adaptive management. Aaron will talk about that more in a minute. And it was designed, the program was designed to ensure California's network is adaptively managed together as a state, incorporating still continuing that stakeholder involvement as we move forward. And it's been shown around the world, too, to be a critical component of success. Success, partnerships, we've talked about it a lot. I've heard it a lot today in a lot of the presentations this morning about how partnerships are critically important. The department is working with a large and diverse group of partners. These are just a few of the kinds of different entities and groups that we're involved in, and it's growing every day. Another example of a good partnership is coming up here pretty soon. So partnerships are critical. And the MPA, again, called for the statewide program. So recognizing that the network transcends geographical, jurisdictional, political boundaries and sectors, the state has invested heavily in a collaborative approach to implement a statewide management program. And we, as one of the managing agencies in partnership with the Ocean Protection Council, together co-lead the statewide MPA leadership team. The team is put together to help, and we have a work plan, and identifying some of the challenges, working together, leveraging capacity and partnerships, and so on and so forth. And Ocean Protection Council is working right now with tribal governments on the best way to get tribal representation on the leadership team. So that is moving forward, and we'll hopefully have that completed very, very soon. So again, partnerships, critically important. The Water Board is definitely there, as is the regional boards on a number of different cases and situations. So again, back to monitoring, and kind of the bridge of partnering is, just recently, the Ocean Protection Council, was it this week? This week. The Ocean Protection Council announced a memorandum of understanding with the State Water Board, Ocean Protection Council, thank you, Coastal Conservancy, with regards to mitigation money that is coming from once through cooling in lieu fees. So that is something that's in the Water Board's policy. It's something that we'll be partnering with Ocean Protection Council. They will be receiving some of those fees, as will the Coastal Conservancy, with regards to putting that money back into mitigation for projects that would benefit impacts to MPAs. So a great collaboration there in our partners. So this is my cue. To turn it over to Aaron in just a second. As I mentioned before, it's going to take a lot of collaboration for monitoring, citizen science groups, ourselves, academics, lots of folks, the regional monitoring frameworks she'll talk about, and long-term monitoring. And at that, I will turn it over to Aaron.
I think there's a board question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Thank you. Very thorough and informative. Good job.
Go ahead. I can take it.
I know you can. I like your sense of humor.
I think you're taking too narrow of a view of our role in protecting water quality. Because it sounds like you and the group have been struggling. Okay, how are we going to make this group fit? Our job, really, is to protect beneficial uses to ensure the integrity, the biological integrity of water. Mm-hmm. I think you've added another beneficial use through the MPA program, and that beneficial use is rest. And I think I'm hoping that Aaron's going to point this out, how these refugia that have been put out there are spawning and rearing habitats for long-lived species like the Sebastes complex, mm-hmm, or abalone. Mm-hmm. So I think if you think of, okay, what is it our job is beneficial use, and in an aqueous system, you know, yeah, it's all water, right? So how do you find a beneficial use? Well, you give them rest,
right,
for these species, because they're getting hounded, right?
Right.
The past couple of years, salmon bites been low. Mm-hmm. Ground fish have been hounded out there. And I'm hoping that the monitoring is showing that some of these long-lived species are benefiting from these MPAs. So I guess what I would ask you to do is not always think about, you know, what's coming out of a pipe or what kind of chemical contaminants, but in the broader definition of protecting beneficial use, I think it's a no-brainer what you're doing.
I agree.
Yeah, stop and I, right
and,
there.
And and Aaron will get into a little bit more of that. What I wanted to show you is kind of how the history of water quality is increased, you know, from the planning process and thinking about it within the planning process and the designation of the MPAs. It got much better in the South and continued in the North Coast. And another piece here to also throw out there is that when related to fish and fisheries management, the Marine Life Management Act and the Marine Life Protection Act were meant by the legislature to be complementary acts. But they were both large scoping pieces of legislation about how to handle those. So they were dealt with separately. The Marine Life Management Act went into place and lots of work went on with there, Marine Protect. And so we are currently working together as a state on how to mold those two together. And Aaron is going to bring up some projects and some things that are happening in the for the long-term monitoring, not just what's happened in baseline monitoring of the MPAs, but also what we're thinking about potentially in long-term monitoring of the MPAs.
Perfect.
To get to that very thing.
And I think, you know, again, when we you can get so focused on the chemical aspects of water, yeah, quality, looking at pH, right, and acidification, looking at sediment impacts on eelgrass formation at the mouths of estuaries. That's all important.
Right.
But I think this notion, you know, whether it's a harbor seal hauling out a pup on a rock so she can get rest because people can't run their dogs through this water or whatever, but I think this notion of rest, spawning, rearing,
yes,
is a beneficial use, and we already cover that. And
yes,
and that's a powerful point of view.
Yeah, and that's part of why in the north, south, and north coast they started looking at ASBSs. But, you know, recognizing exactly that kind of thing. So I appreciate you bringing that up. And remember, this is a 30,000 to 45,000 foot strafing run on MPAs. So happy to come back again and talk more detail. But Aaron,
and then just one quick comment.
I'm sorry, John.
I think what this is doing is We've had a very great state board response. I don't speak for any other regional boards, but I think we've been slower to adopt to this major change in California policy. That's understandable. We were busy with our business. They were busy with theirs. But I do think the regional board, if you want to look at it over a 10-year period of time, has some real opportunities to help with the implementation and be supportive of the state board and supportive of Fish and Wildlife and the Marine Reserve Program.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, thank you, Becky, for that intro to the MPA program. And thank you, Chairman Corbett and other board members for inviting us to give the presentation today. So as Becky said, I'm going to dial in a little bit and provide an overview of how we monitor our marine protected areas here in California. So I'm Erin Meyer. I'm a senior scientist with the California Ocean Science Trust. I'm also our senior program manager of our MPA monitoring program. But before I dive in, I should probably tell you a little bit about who the Ocean Science Trust is. So we were established by state legislation. So the Coastal Ocean Resources Stewardship Act of 2000 established the California Ocean Science Trust. And we're a boundary organization. And basically, we're dedicated to bringing sound science to resource managers and policymakers to help them make informed decisions about managing our marine resources. We're an independent nonprofit organization. As such, we bring together local, state, federal, and tribal scientists, fishermen, and other citizens to build trust and understanding in ocean and coastal science. We work in close collaboration with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, the California Ocean Protection Council, and California Sea Grant to plan and implement baseline monitoring of the state's network of marine protected areas. We're also working together with the Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Ocean Protection Council as we begin launching and planning for long-term monitoring of those same marine protected areas. And the data that come through MPA monitoring provides the state with rigorous science to inform policy and management decisions into the future, such as evaluations of MPA effectiveness in achieving the goals of the Marine Life Protection Act that you just heard a lot about. In addition, MPA monitoring can inform decisions and management actions related to other issues like water quality, climate change, and fisheries. In 2010, working in close collaboration with the department, we finalized a new MPA monitoring framework. This was developed through a series of public workshops with experts from across California and beyond. It identifies 10 ecosystem features, which includes 8 ecological habitats, as well as consumptive and non-consumptive human activities. And it's designed to be implemented at multiple scales by groups with varying level of expertise. And this framework was adopted by the Fish and Game Commission in 2010. Since then, that monitoring framework has been applied to develop regional monitoring plans for the North Central Coast region, which was adopted in 2010, again, by the Fish and Game Commission, and subsequently was applied to developing 2 other regional monitoring plans for the South Coast and Central Coast regions. And it will serve as a guide for baseline monitoring across the state. And it's also going to be one of the foundational documents that will inform the development of a statewide long-term monitoring action plan that, under the leadership of the department, will begin to develop in early 2017. Now, monitoring is implemented in 2 phases, and Becky mentioned this a little bit earlier, but the first stage of that is regional baseline monitoring, which begins at or near the time of MPA implementation. So it started at different times across the state because those regional MPAs came and hit the water at different times. And then it's transitioning now into statewide long-term monitoring. However, between baseline and long-term, there are 2 very, very important steps: sharing results from baseline monitoring and adaptive management, again, that you heard a lot about from Becky. And these are vital components to success, of course, of any monitoring program. And these steps are also part of the cycle, of course, for long-term monitoring, which will include data collection, integration and synthesis, sharing results, and then, of course, again, adaptive management. Now, following the establishment of each regional MPA network, the Ocean Science Trust has worked closely with its state partners and scientists to establish a baseline or a benchmark of both ecological and socioeconomic conditions. And establishing a benchmark of ocean conditions and human activities is a really important step toward understanding future changes, and it informs our approach that we're currently developing for long-term monitoring. It's also key to understanding how the region's MPAs are performing into the future. It serves as that benchmark we can compare future data back to. Now, to help establish this baseline, researchers, citizen scientists, tribal, state, and federal governments, fishermen, and others conducted on-the-ground monitoring as part of a state-funded MPA baseline program. And this program is implemented as a partnership among these four groups, again, the Department, the Ocean Protection Council, Sea Grant, and the Ocean Science Trust. Now, California is committed to a partnership-based approach. You keep hearing that word over the course of the day today, so this may be the most convoluted logo soup you've seen today. For baseline monitoring, we've worked with over 70 different organizations and tribes across the state of California to implement baseline monitoring, and we're, of course, looking to continue these partnerships going forward into long-term monitoring. Of course, the strength of this approach, there are many strengths, and it's pretty simple. It leverages existing monitoring capacity across the state, making state dollars go farther. It broadens participation in monitoring, and it also incorporates multiple knowledge types from academic and tribal science to traditional fishermen's and local knowledge. Now, as I mentioned previously, an important component of MPA monitoring is sharing results, and thus far the results are pretty encouraging. It can take many years to see impacts from MPAs and understand regional trends. However, data from some of the longer-term monitoring programs that were pre-existing in our state provide us with a glimpse at some recent changes. So just to give a couple of examples from the North Central Coast region, some remotely operated vehicle surveys in the deeper waters off our shores up here, both inside and outside of MPAs, mostly around 2015, found some increases in abundances of mainly rockfishes or the Sebastes complex and lingcod. And again, just over a short time period, already seeing some increases in those species. Now, there are also there were surveys conducted in 2014 and 2015 in the North Central Coast that found some kind of declines, actually, in kelp forests up in this region, followed by some high sea urchin densities, surpassing anything seen in the region over the past 10 years. This is leading researchers to start examining the role even more closely of changing ocean conditions and the mass sea star die-off. And just to note, data and results from the North Coast Baseline Program will be coming online next summer, just starting to roll in next summer. Now, however, it's as I mentioned, it's important to keep in mind that the goals of baseline monitoring are focused on establishing a benchmark of conditions. So it's not actually targeting trying to find initial changes because we're only collecting data for about 2 to 3 years. But speaking in terms of scientific terms, 2 to 3 years is not a very long time to look for change. And so, you know, these points that I just made are mainly for data over very short time periods. So it's hard to draw kind of real big conclusions from those. But we do have some protected areas in the state that have been in place for longer periods of time. And the science is really showing that those longer term trends are more appropriate when you have data sets that are in the order of 10, 15, or 20 years. And we have, for example, down south, we have the Channel Islands where those protected areas have been in place for 10 years. And in some analyses of those data, which actually were released last year, there's a comprehensive report released from that monitoring program off the Channel Islands. And they are seeing increases in size and abundance of fished species, both inside, as expected, but also outside of MPAs. And that's something that is just really encouraging, that we're actually seeing some of that spillover, so to speak, from inside the protected areas to outside. Now, just to say, all findings and reporting products, together with all the synthesized products, et cetera, are part of baseline reporting, and they're all presented to the California Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Fish and Game Commission to inform that 5-year adaptive management review of each regional MPA. So the results that I was presenting and what you're seeing here are some of these state of the region reports and shorter reports that are developed that are all going to inform that first initial 5-year review of how the MPAs are doing in each region. Now, more broadly, the results from baseline monitoring can inform the management of fisheries, water quality, coastal development, climate change, you name it, as well as the interests and priorities of California's diverse ocean community. And we have an unprecedented soon statewide data set of both ecological and socioeconomic conditions, and it's ready for use by all people, whether you're a resource manager or a policymaker or a fisherman or another interested member of the public. And these data have already been put to work in a couple of examples that I just wanted to mention here. That, for example, some data from the North Central Coast Baseline Program, together with some data from the Department of Fish and Wildlife, helped inform the response to an abalone fishery die-off that happened back in 2010 because of a HAB event. So those data were put to work to help us understand the impacts of that HAB event. Similarly, there was was an oil spill off of Refugio down south. Again, the baseline data from that region helped the state to understand what the impacts are of that oil spill because we had data from before that event happened. So these data have already proved useful in helping to understand some catastrophic events. And just to say out loud, the technical reports, summaries, and other documents that I'm talking about are all publicly available on a website called oceanspaces.org. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later. So we're committed to broadening participation in research and monitoring, which not only provides hands-on learning experiences, but can also increase understanding and awareness of the MPAs, and thus, in a lot of cases, compliance. It engages community members in data collection, which can increase buy-in of those results. For example, from this region up in the North Coast, tribes are partnering or leading four projects as part of the North Coast MPA Baseline Program, and fishermen have been involved in several projects across the state, including four projects here in the North Coast. Now, broadening participation also lends itself to bringing together multiple sources of knowledge. I mentioned this previously, but just feel like I should say it again. Again, just such as traditional knowledge, fishermen's knowledge, and citizen science. And those are components of most of the baseline programs across the state. And this provides us a more comprehensive understanding and interpretation of ecosystem conditions and trends. Now, in addition to all that I've walked through thus far, we're also working to find opportunities to bridge water quality and MPA monitoring efforts. And here are some examples of connections between MPA and water quality monitoring and activities. I'm using the South Coast region as a case study because this is the region that we're currently developing and writing up those baseline monitoring results. These are kind of top of mind right now. So we're working with the Regional Water Quality Monitoring Program, or BITE 13, down south to incorporate, they actually already have incorporated MPA questions into that BITE 13 report, and we're working with them to incorporate those results into South Coast baseline reporting. There was some research that we began a few years ago in collaboration with SCWRP, and I always say it wrong, the Southern California Coastal Water Research Program or Project. One of the two, working in collaboration with them to do some research to look at water quality factors and fishing impacts and kind of try and tease those apart a little bit to get a better feel for what's impacting and how the kelp forests off the coast down south. And then we're also in the process of bringing on board a joint fellow with SCWRP and the water boards that'll be sitting with us for the next 12 months to tackle some of these projects and, again, looking across and linking across these programs. And just to say again that the North Coast will be transitioning into its data integration and synthesis phase next year. So we look forward to working with the water boards up here in the north to figure out ways to bring in data and information that might be of interest to you. And we're committed to continuing to explore ways to link these two things together. Becky mentioned previously this MPA statewide leadership team. We worked really closely with the water boards to incorporate a particular action item just to show the commitment to bringing together the water quality and marine protected area monitoring programs and finding places of alignment and places that the data that are coming through in each of those programs can help support the efforts and missions and visions of both of those programs. Now, we're currently in transition from regional baseline monitoring to statewide long-term monitoring. It's underway in the North Central, Central, and South Coast regions. And this scientifically robust partnership-based approach to monitoring rely on baseline information to assess how California's network is performing in meeting the goals, again, of the Marine Life Protection Act. This just highlights a few of the documents that I've already mentioned that are going to be involved in helping to inform that program as it goes forward. And I mentioned this website previously. So this is the oceanspaces.org website. So all of the data, results, et cetera, are all publicly available and downloadable on this website. But it's not just about data and results. It's also intended to be a community engagement platform. So it's a place where members of the community can go, engage with the data, learn more, even post blogs if you have doing activities that might be of interest to the broader public. You can read blogs and just stay up to date of all the things that are going on, not just about MPA monitoring, but about other state issues as well. And I've mentioned a little bit about how we're putting the MPAs to work already, but MPA, like all management tools, are sitting in this backdrop of unprecedented environmental change and many multiple stressors. We recently released, the Ocean Science Trust recently released a report produced by the West Coast Ocean Acidification and Hypoxia Science Panel. This report highlights some recommendations and guidelines for managing in the face of change. And we're currently working to address some of the questions that you see on this slide, many of which emerged through that report. And these are questions that are being tackled, so to speak, through the Ocean Protection Council Science Advisory Team and some working groups that have formed out of the last workshop from that. We also, and just bring this up because it came up several presentations before, but we recently released a harmful algal bloom FAQ document, which provides a thorough overview of the issue and some of the most recent questions that have been received by the state and others. We worked closely with the state on developing that as well, so that's a document that we can provide if folks are interested. And then just finally, another logo sloop slide, because why not? when it comes to understanding climate change, with the Ocean Protection Council, the OPC-SAT, the Ocean Science Trust, the state has in place the infrastructure needed to leverage investments, reduce risk, and serve the state broadly. And again, in all things, working really closely with the department and the water boards and the other members of the MPA statewide leadership team, which brings together the 7 state coastal and ocean managing agencies, as well as our federal partners, the Collaborative Network and the Ocean Science Trust. So it's a really important team that we can lean on to help make sure that we are really doing this with a multi-jurisdictional approach. And I'll pause there.
Okay, board members?
Yes. Okay.
Go ahead if you
have
more.
No, I was just going to say that concludes our presentation. So we are here to answer questions. And again, thank you for inviting us to come.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
First off, thank you so much for coming. Thank you for your work. It's so interesting. I agree with Board Member Giusti, that we actually sometimes just concentrate and see inland. Certainly, we do have a piece of the water quality equation as it pertains to ocean resources. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I'm actually astonished sometimes about the amount of trash that's in our waterways. Mm-hmm. And I know that San Francisco Bay Regional Board, actually, and some of the other regional boards have had trash DMDLs. Mm-hmm. Have you dealt with that specifically, or how have you seen that in the ocean resources? Besides the great garbage patch that's out there, I mean, there's nearshore. I know that Ocean Cleanup Days and some of the participatory agencies and nonprofits or groups that are out there doing ocean cleanups, beach cleanups, I should say. But what do you see out there on that?
Well, there's also a group doing derelict gear retrieval as right. well. So that and doing that statewide, which is huge. But other than that.
So the, and this is actually a really recent project that we just got funding to do in support with the Ocean Protection Council in response to the Water Board's trash policy. So working with the Water Boards to look at trash monitoring methods and really figure out if they're working and getting at the types of information that we're looking for and really looking at that nexus between what's going on land and what's going on along our coast. So hopefully about 6 months from now, we'll have a little bit more to say about that.
Can I actually ask, too, the federal limit, I believe, is what, 200 miles off coast is a federal limit? The MPAs, I've run into MPAs on the North Coast because I rockfish sometimes off the coast. And, boy, you really got to watch.
Good for you. Yes.
Well, thank you. You really got to watch where they are, though, because,
yes.
And be aware of where they are.
Yes.
And sometimes, looking at a map just won't do it. You really got to sluice that out some. But how does it overlap between Ocean Protection Council? I was asking John while you were talking about. That's a state. A lot of your association is state here. But how about how does a federal limit then overlay, or how does the federal regulations overlay as it pertains to that, or do they?
Well, they do, or they can. There are federal MPAs around the Northern Channel Islands that are butt up against. Most of them are stacked on top of the state marine protected areas in the Northern Channel Islands, and those federal MPAs were put in place after the state ones were. That's the only place in the state right now where there are federal marine protected areas in the same kind of venue that our state ones are. And those federal ones followed a similar process in terms of the kinds of regulations and things they wanted to see. Most of them around the Channel Islands, I think, are reserves, I think. Yep. Most of them are, you know, attached to whether it's state reserves or whatever. Most of the federal ones are reserves. So that's, you know, in that way, from a very pragmatic look at it, there, you know, our state line stops at 3 miles. The federal line goes from there and beyond, sometimes 200. So the department and the state works very closely, like on fisheries management issues, with the Pacific Fisheries Management Council, of which a lot of the other states, California, Washington, Oregon, Idaho, also NOAA Fisheries, work together on, and they've got a habitat committee, they've got ecosystem committees, fisheries management, lots of things. So there's a big consortium there that looks at the rockfish conservation areas, and there's a new federal legislation about looking at protecting seamounts and, you know, lots of different things. So then the sanctuaries, you know, up and down the coast, they're overlapping, but don't bump into each other too much in terms of conflicting laws.
Cordell Banks would be an example of probably, yes, a federal. That's a federal, I believe, right?
Yes, yes. Federal. Okay. And Gulf of the Farallones, Monterey Bay Sanctuary, yeah, as you go up and down the coast. So the sanctuary waters are much broader than the state waters. So, but there, again, we talked about those overlapping jurisdictions and authorities. That's exactly what the kind of thing we're,
yeah,
talking about.
Sure. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, I just thought, I think the grossest rule is the state has it 3 nautical miles out.
Yes.
The feds to 200 miles. After that, it gets very complex.
It's very complex, yes.
And I thought Becky did a great job of describing that. And then, of course, State Lands Commission is in there, as well as,
yes,
Coastal Commission,
yes,
as well as Water Quality, just to make it a happy California,
yes,
agency family.
Yes.
I just had a, first of all, I wanted to thank you for your presentation. I think Ocean Science Trust is just doing an outstanding science job, and compared to other efforts, you have gained a lot of respect from a large number of divergent groups because they think you're doing good science. I did want to say Gleason, before she, which was one of the backers of MLPA, wrote of the need to do assessments, and one area that didn't happen in MLPA is for anadromous fish, so sturgeon, eulachon, and salmon were left out.
Right.
And probably the key area to target assessments are blocked river mouths and blocked lagoons,
mm-hmm,
because they're highly vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
The Mad River, for example, where we were closed off in the 1800s, the local folks went out to the closed-off river and just took spears from the bank of the ocean. And 137 years later, even with the fish hatchery and even with augmented summer water, it still hasn't recovered.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a highly vulnerable population, and that was just sort of excluded by some of the model assumptions. So I think getting a gap assessment of that would,
mm-hmm,
be very, very valuable. I want to say the West Coast hypoxia was beyond, it was one of the most efficient, smartest bureaucratic private moves I've seen in 10 years. Instead of going through MOUs between all the states, they just open it up to the West Coast scientists. They increased then the pool of your really top-level scientists, and they just did it, and all the state governments had to run to catch up with them and say, oh, yeah, we approve, because they were already doing it. And so I thought that was really excellent. Lastly, I just wanted to say, just so people know, you might want to very briefly describe the Ocean Science Panel, and then we are very I'm very happy to report we have a staff member who's been appointed to that prestigious panel. So why don't you describe it and maybe introduce our staff member and who serves on it, who's in the audience today.
Yeah, so the Ocean Protection Council Science Advisory Team consists of, and I'm going to get the number wrong because we just changed it, mm-hmm, 20... six, I want to say, scientists across every possible ocean-related discipline that you can imagine, from geologists to coast people who have expertise in coastal development, to ecologists, to physical oceanographers, to folks with traditional knowledge expertise, et cetera, and social science. I don't know why I forgot that one. So broad areas of expertise, and they're called upon by the Ocean Protection Council mainly, but also increasingly by the Department of Fish and Wildlife to tackle questions that are coming up that might be of interest to those state agencies. I'm sure just to call them out, they probably would be open to receiving questions and invitations also from the water boards in questions of high scientific interest. They tackle these questions, and they're meant to be conduits to the broader scientific community. So while issues are usually discussed in their biannual or annual workshops, they also then oftentimes spin off into working groups and draw on scientists from outside of the Ocean Protection Council Science Advisory Team to join those working groups to develop anything from, for example, the Ocean Acidification Hypoxia Science Panel report to a short white paper to just position papers, et cetera. So they've done kind of the broad suite of different types of documents over the years. And just recently, I want to say two years ago, the OPC SAT expanded its doors to include three seats of tribal representatives from the state. And as Chairman Corbett mentioned, you have somebody on your staff who was invited into one of those seats, and that is Chuck Striplin.
All right, thank you. And I also wanted just to, for board members that don't know, our former executive director went to serve as executive director for the Ocean Protection Council, and she recently has left that position, but she was there for quite a few years. So we have quite a nexus of our staff, and we also are very lucky with our state board representative who's taken, even though he's smiling, leadership on, I think, on marine issues. And I think as this regional board progresses, that's a really good knowledge base for us to move forward. So,
and just one other thing that could be helpful for you to know is that Nancy Sutley and John Bishop are also on the Ocean Science Trust Board.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Don't run off, though, until after Paul.
No,
okay.
We're stepping back.
We're here.
Okay, great. Well, good afternoon.